content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Cindy Fowler from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Dave's Garden e-newsletter, the Triangle Gardener magazine, and the Garden Helper website, and maybe from Carrots Love Tomatoes and Roses Love Garlic by Louise Riote. And we'll start with Dave's Garden e-newsletter. Harvesting and Preparing Acorns by Dawn Hammond. Learn how this little nut is something worth foraging for on your next nature hike. An acorn is actually just a nut produced by the oak tree, and as such, this useful staple is abundant throughout regions where oak trees grow. With minimal processing, the acorn is an edible nut and one that is easy to source for a number of different applications. Most commonly ground into flour, acorns also offer a base similar to polenta, also known by the less appealing moniker acorn mush. To understand modern ways to process acorns, it's helpful to know a bit about its ethnobotany. Historical, and cultural value. Acorns have been a food source for Native Americans for 4,000 years. Processing them for food was mainly women's work. It was a laborious process, though a necessary one, since acorns were a mainstay in their diet. Once processed, they could be used to quickly prepare a meal of soup, mush, or bread. Like most staples, acorn flour stored and traveled well, which was useful for the nomadic people. Tribes also used acorns as a commodity in trades, exchanging for spices, foods, or products not available in the region. Nutrient value. While historically acorns were likely seen as a food source that was readily available and shelf-stable, they were and are a nutrient-dense food option. 1 ounce of acorn contains about 2 grams of protein, 9 grams of fat, 15 grams of carbs, 4 grams of fiber, and 12% of your recommended daily intake for potassium, along with vitamin A, vitamin E, iron, vitamin B6, folate, and manganese. Just as there are different types of oak trees, there are different types of acorns. In fact, there are 450 species of oak that produce acorns, mostly located in North America. They offer a range of flavors. However, they all share similar enough qualities to be grouped together in discussing harvest and preparation. How to harvest. Harvesting acorns requires a bit of back work from constantly bending, but basically is as easy as picking them up from the ground. If you can beat the squirrels to them, collect acorns from the ground or shake out of the tree in autumn as they begin to naturally drop. Be sure to watch for rotten shells or those that are too green, as many early in the season are. If they still have a portion of the branch attached, they are likely not quite ripe. Those that are overripe can mold inside the shell. The shell will be a dark brown during the perfect harvest maturity, so skip the first batch to drop and evaluate shell color during your selection. All acorns need to be thoroughly dried. Traditionally, tribes laid them out in the sun to complete this task and then put them in a basket on an elevated platform so they could get proper air circulation, but away from hungry critters. Tribes used pine needles or wormwood to further discourage four-legged pests. With modern advancements, acorns in their shells can be dried inside the house. Use a spare room or a storage area. If not laid flat, simply stir the nuts weekly while they dry to avoid moisture buildup that could lead to mold. Processing. Acorns contain tannic acid, a bitter substance that makes them unpleasant to eat and difficult to digest. Fortunately, it is easy to remove through processing. Leaching out tannic acid was achieved by native tribes in a variety of ways. For example, tribes in the California region used a leaching basin constructed with layers of fine and coarse sand, pouring water over the flower prepared it for use. In Oregon, tribes stored the acorns in the river to naturally allow water to filter out the tannins. With all techniques, processing acorns to prepare for consumption was very time-consuming. First, the acorns were cracked and the inner kernel removed. The skin around the nut was also removed, and then the kernel was ground down using a mortar and pestle. Once ground, the mixture was sifted through a finely woven basket to filter out any remaining skin, shell, and husk. The resulting ground material became a type of flour used in traditional Native American cooking. Hammering through the hard shell is still somewhat laborious, but can be achieved with a nutcracker or hammer, which is much easier than the Native American technique of using a rock. One pointer. If nuts are allowed to thoroughly dry, many of them will crack naturally, saving you this laborious step. The modern method to leach out tannins is simply to boil the nuts. Once removed from their shells, boil until the water turns brown. Then, rinse and repeat in fresh water until the water remains clear. If you want to explore a version of the cold water filter method, simply put the nuts in mesh bags and dangle them in your clean toilet tank, not the bowl, where the flushing mechanism will filter out the tannins. Preparation. Once dried and tannins removed, you can use your nuts as you would most others. Try roasting them with your favorite combination of sweet or savory flavors at 375 degrees for about 15 to 20 minutes. Raw acorns can be safely stored for months, so they are a great addition to your survival stockpile or pantry shelves. And from the Garden Helper website, how to choose healthy plants for your house or garden. From a garden center, nursery, or store, as you enter the nursery or garden center, look around at the selection. You may know the kind of plant you're looking for, or may browse until you find the flower or plant that rings your bell. That's usually the easiest part. Now you must decide which specimen out of the dozens to take home with you. There are several aspects you should consider in making your decision. The prettiest plant is not necessarily the healthiest or the best buy. You can purchase plants almost anywhere. You find them in your neighborhood grocery store, discount warehouse, or even at a garage sale. To me, this is like going into a car dealer to buy a cake. That is not to say the plant you pick up outside the grocery store won't be healthy or a nursery plant will be in good shape. When you shop for plants at a nursery or garden center, you are dealing with people who have grown that plant and hopefully know how to care for it. Regardless of where you do plant shopping, there are a few things to look out for to ensure the quality of your purchase. Take a look at the general health of all the plants in the nursery, not just of a particular variety. If you see very many sickly-looking plants, I'd recommend heading on down the road. Better safe than sorry. Unlike the seasonal stock of annual and perennial plants, you'll find house plants may reside in the nursery for a year or longer. During this time, they may be exposed to many common houseplant pests. If you find spider mites, mealybugs, or any other harmful insects in the houseplant department, They may have already infested the plant you like as well. I'd recommend heading on down the road. Once decided on the plant I want, I choose about a half a dozen of the healthiest looking plants and set them off to the side. Then I go back for a closer examination of the different parts of each plant before making my decision. Selecting the right plant. Look closely for insect pests and signs of disease. Avoid tall, spindly plants. A short, bushy plant will transplant easier and is more likely to grow into a nice specimen. The roots provide the food for the plant and are of utmost importance. It's essential there is a healthy, robust root ball which fills or nearly fills the planter. On the other hand, you don't want a root system compacted into the pot so densely it's choking itself out. It is inappropriate to remove the plant from the pot yourself, but if you have doubts about the condition of the roots, you may be able to convince the nurseryman to do it for you. Normally, you can look at the drainage holes and get a pretty good idea of what's going on inside the pot. A few, but not too many, roots should be beginning to poke through the drain holes. These roots should not be dry or brittle. No roots should be showing above the surface of the soil. Stems and trunks will determine the shape and fullness of the plant. The main stem should be thick and healthy in appearance. I feel it's better to have 4 or 5 main stems and just a few lesser branches than to have a mass of small branches with one big stick in the middle. Stems should be spaced evenly around the plant, unless this is a single-stemmed plant, such as a Diefenbachia. Look for abrasions, breaks, or other stem damage which may be slowly killing the plant. Foliage should be clean and show no signs of wilting. Leaves should appear to be strong and healthy. The foliage color should be bright. Check for spotting, leaf edge burn, or other common plant problems. A single burned leaf can be snipped, but if the entire plant shows signs of distress, forget it. Flowering plants should have fresh, tightly formed buds. It's nice to see the plant in full bloom, but if it is fully flowered now, you may not see it bloom in your garden until the following year. This is especially true with rhododendrons, azaleas, and other flowering shrubs. Some perennials and most annuals have an extended blooming period, so with these plants, this is not a major concern but should be considered. Willie the garden gnome. When you bring your plants home, allow them to acclimatize themselves by placing them in the shade and then gradually bring them into their proper lighting. Be sure to keep them well watered until they are ready to plant into the ground. It is best to plant them in the garden on an overcast day. And from Dave's garden website, here's some information on the Love in a Mist, Nigella damascena. This native of southern Europe has been popular with gardeners for hundreds of years. Elizabethan cottage gardens often sported these lacy and delicate blossoms. While they may look frail, Nigella damascena is a tough little annual that happily reseeds and reliably returns each year. Some gardeners find it may reseed with too much enthusiasm and grumble about unwanted seedlings, but the cheery flowers in shades of blue, white, and lavender seem to be at home wherever they sprout. If you want to prevent surprise seedlings, simply deadhead the flowers as they fade. Love in a Mist likes sunny, well-drained conditions and moderately fertile soil. They grow to 12 to 18 inches and form loose clumps. The unique seed pods are as attractive as the blossoms, but they tend to explode when ripe and will disperse their contents across the garden. The bloom time of year is late spring and early summer, midsummer, late summer, early fall, and midfall. Sun requirements. Sun to partial shade. And then there's the Tillandsia bromeliad. Many people know Tillandsia iananthe as the air plant, mistakenly assuming it lives on air. While it does not require soil or a traditional pot, this native of Mexico and Central America needs regular food and water just like any other plant. Special cells on the surface of the leaves trap moisture and food, but it does have a cool system that attaches itself to tree bark or a rough surface. Grow it in bright, indirect light and warm temps. Reduce nighttime temps to around 50 degrees Fahrenheit during winter to promote flowering. Use half-strength liquid fertilizer every other week for best results. Tillandsia iononta is a cousin of the familiar iconic plant of the American South, Spanish moss. Both plants are epiphytic, which means that they grow upon another plant but do not depend upon it for nourishment like a parasitic plant would. The bloom color? Purple bloom time of year, mid-fall, late fall, early winter. Sun requirements are sun to partial shade and light shade. Now from the Triangle Gardeners magazine, the plant focus is Growing Beauty Berry by Mark Wethington. Fruiting shrubs are among the top treats for the autumn garden, especially in South, where fall foliage can be pretty poor most years. While the reds of the hollies and oranges of Pyracantha are lovely, the surprising purple of beauty berry is a breath of fresh air in the garden. Calicarpa, more commonly known as beauty berry, is a widespread group of shrubs and trees found in Asia and North America and into South America and even Australia and Madagascar. The temperate species from Asia and North America are all deciduous medium to large shrubs. Although it's a large group, around 150 species, there are relatively few that are typically found in gardens. They all bear dense clusters of small white to lavender flowers in summer, followed by very showy glossy fruits, typically purple with a metallic sheen, but white, pink, and dark red-violet species and selections occur. The flowers on all garden species support a diversity of pollinators, and the fruits are eaten by birds, although they are generally not most birds' first choice. Three main species make up the most commonly found forms in nurseries. One is a southeastern U.S. native. The other two are from Asia. Our native beauty berry, Calicarpa americana, makes a large shrub growing 6 feet or more tall and wide with large, felted leaves. The lavender flowers are attractive up close, but are mostly obscured by the foliage at a distance, but the fruit show is simply glorious. Tight clusters of brilliant purple BB-sized fruit appear at each new leaf node along the stem. It fruits best in full sun, but will tolerate considerable shade. Plant it in a moist, well-drained to permanently damp spot. An odd characteristic of American beauty berry is that if you rub the foliage on your skin, it deters mosquitoes as well as most spray repellents. Both Asian species of beauty berry, commonly seen in the U.S., are native across most of the southern half of China and into Japan. Calicarpa japonica is generally smaller than our native beauty berry in all respects, growing to about 5 feet tall and wide, with a somewhat upright habit and mid-sized leaves. The flowers are often paler than either of other species and give rise to clusters of small purple fruits. C. dichotoma is the smallest of the beauty berries, generally only growing to about 4 feet tall and wide. Although more diminutive in most respects, leaf size and fruit size, it actually has larger clusters of flowers and fruit than its Asian counterpart. Both of these species can be grown like their American relative, but have less of a tolerance for permanently wet soils. There are a variety of named selections of beauty berry, including the beautifully white-margined C. dichotoma duet, released by the U.S. National Arboretum. While this form is lovely all summer, it rarely sets any fruit. A new selection has been released from Dr. Tom Rennie's breeding program at NC State University. Pearl Glam grows upright to about 5 feet tall and only 3 feet wide. The foliage is purple and has light pink-white flowers followed by a heavy purple fruit set. If you find yourself bitten by the beauty berry bug, other selections are available through Better Garden Centers and specialty mail-order nurseries. All beauty berries flower and fruit on new wood, so plants can be cut to the ground each winter to control size and promote more flowering and fruiting. And events coming up: Oaks of North Carolina, October the 24th, 9:30 a.m. until 3 p.m. Learn more about our native oaks, including their biology, how to identify and distinguish them, and how they interact with other species and native plant communities. There's a fee, and you have to pre-register. This happens at Sarah P. Duke Gardens in Durham. Call 919-668-1707, 919-668-1707, or go to gardenseducation@duke.edu. And a botanical family festival, October the 25th, 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. Celebrate the fall with a fun evening of hands-on nature activities. Come dressed in your favorite plant or animal costume. Food trucks, and it's for all ages, and there is a fee. Pre-registration is required. This will happen at the North Carolina Botanical Garden in Chapel Hill. You can go to their site, ncbg.unc.edu, for more information. Now, from Carrots Love Tomatoes and Roses Love Garlic by Louise Riot. There's some information for you. El Campane. My German heritage bids me have great respect for El Campane, sometimes called horse heel or horse alder. This herb was under the protection of the goddess Holda, who first taught mortals the art of spinning and weaving flax. Candied El Campane, according to a 17th century herbal, was thought to cause mirth. El Campane came to America as a healer, being introduced into gardens as a home remedy. Finding the climate congenial, it went native and now grows wild in many places. The substance most abundantly contained in El Campane root is inulin, a sort of invert starch, usable as a replacement for ordinary starch in the diet of diabetics. It also contains a volatile oil and several identifiable crystalline substances. The thick yellow taproot has the odor of camphor. El Campane once was used in England for the heaves in horses. As far back as 1885, a Dr. Korab demonstrated that the active bitter principle of the plant, called helenin, was a powerful antiseptic and bactericide, particularly destructive to the tubercle bacillus. El Campane in the garden provides a 6-foot-tall accent of bright yellow in midsummer, when the large arrayed flowers stand above the enormous felty leaves. The plants are useful in providing a bit of shade for lower-growing mints. Fennel. Most plants dislike fennel, and it is one herb that should be planted well away from the vegetable garden, since it has an inhibiting effect on bush beans, caraway, kohlrabi, and tomatoes. Fennel, planted away from the garden, is valuable for its masses of fringed foliage. At one time, the fragrant seeds, which smell and taste like fringed, like licorice, were made into a tea soothing to colicky babies. Mixed with peppermint leaves, it also makes a delicious tea for adults. Fennel is inhibited by the presence of coriander and will not form seed. It also dislikes wormwood. Garlic. The Babylonians and Hindus knew of garlic's medicinal power 3,000 years ago, and it was well known to the ancient Egyptians, who fed great quantities of garlic to the workers who built the pyramids. The Greek physicians, fathers of present-day medicine, used garlic in their prescriptions, and it was rationed to the soldiers of the mighty Roman armies. The 800-year-old medical school of Salerno included garlic in its Materia Medica, and it always has been one of the standbys of folk medicine practitioners. Garlic is an effective control for many insects. Try this recipe for garden use. Take 3 to 4 ounces of chopped garlic bulbs and soak in 2 tablespoons of mineral oil for a day. Add 1 pint of water in which 1 teaspoon of fish emulsion has been dissolved. Stir well. Strain the liquid and store in a glass or china container as it reacts with metals. Dilute this, starting with 1 part to 2 20-parts of water, and use as a spray against your worst insect pests. If sweet potatoes or other garden plants are attracting rabbits, try this spray. Rabbits dislike the smell of fish, too, so fish emulsion may help. Garlic sprays are useful in controlling late blight on tomatoes and potatoes. Garlic is an effective destroyer of the diseases that damage stone fruits, cucumbers, radishes, spinach, beans, nuts, and tomatoes. A garlic-based oil sprayed on breeding ponds showed a 100% kill of mosquito larvae in a University of California experiment. Garlic cloves stored in the grain are good against grain weevils. Garlic grown in a circle around fruit trees is good against borers. It is beneficial to the growth of vetch and is protective planted with roses. All alliums, however, inhibit the growth of peas and beans. Plant garlic with tomatoes against red spider. I have done this for 3 successive years with good results. Whorehound. In centuries past, virtues attributed to whorehound included the power to cure snake bite and merit as a fly repellent, firmifuge, and an ointment for wounds and itches. The Hebrew name for the plant, marab, means a bitter juice. It was one of the 5 bitter herbs required to be eaten at the Passover feast. We've run out of time for today's episode of Out in the Garden. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Cindy Fowler, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. You have been listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. So long until next time. If you have any comment or questions, please call 919-832-5138. This is available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website.